Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking about the stranglehold Ticketmaster Live Nation has on the concert industry and how it hurts music fans. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We talk with New York Times writer Ben Cesario about the exorbitant ticket prices for concerts by superstars ranging from Beyonce to Bruce Springsteen. But first, some new music from Carolyn Polachek. That's a track called Bunny is a Rider, a single that's been out for a number of months, and it has wound up on the new Carolyn Polachek album, Desire, I Want to Turn Into You. Now, depending on how you're counting, it's either her fourth studio album or her second under her given name. The first two projects were credited to Ramona Lisa in 2014 and CEP in 2017, but now she's gone to her given name on the last two. Pang was the first official in 2019 under her own name. She started out, as an indie darling with that duo Chairlift, primarily with Patrick Wemberly. A series of albums between 2008-2017. Chairlift broke up in 2017. Along the way, she's become a songwriter for Beyonce and Travis Scott. She's done collaborations with artists like Blood Orange, Charlie XCX, Grimes. A very prolific artist, dabbling in a number of different areas. This is the new album, Desire, I Want to Turn Into You, and here's a track from it, I Believe, on Sound Opinions. I Believe by Carolyn Polachek from Desire, I Want to Turn Into You. What a great title, Greg. And there is a lot of sensuality on this record, along with a lot of other moods that Carolyn explores and expresses. This artist is a fantastic songwriter.
mining that fine line between indie electronic experimentation and mainstream pop. And you hear, you know, the, I believe is like a stadium rousing pop song, right? A great pop song that doesn't insult our intelligence or resort to standard formulas. I would say, though, that on this album, one of Caroline's problems is that in trying to avoid the formulaic that dominates so much pop music, she turns to an embrace of the esoteric that at times can be distracting. What do you mean, Jim? There's a youth choir on Billions that ends the album, you know? There's yodeling and whistling. Wow. There's Spanish guitar. And I think that this everything and the kitchen sink approach to trying to be eclectic, willfully break formulas, and it doesn't always serve her songs. If we were to strip down these songs to the bare essence of an empowered woman who has been hurt in the past. You know, she has sung about heartbreak in some of her many other projects under all those different titles you were talking about. And now she wants to embrace desire from a position of strength and seemingly security, having survived the pandemic, like all of us. She's ready to go out again, and she's ready to tackle the world. Those are the great uplifting moments. But man, it's like, Caroline, you could have pulled back on the production some.
Well, you know, what you're talking about is that sort of genre-free, generation-spanning approach to pop music that we've been seeing for at least the last decade. A lot of artists are, you know, no longer staying in their lane, per se, and, you know, really opening up the world to whatever they want to do. We just reviewed a record, you know, Lil Yachty's record is an example of that, where, you know, ostensibly he's a hip-hop artist, but he's got all this other stuff going on in the record, and some people don't like that.
Well, I embrace that. I hate artists feeling pigeonholed in a genre.
I think it's a wonderful trend, and I think it's going to continue because of the world we're living in. You know, her record cover, I mean, for people who still pay attention to those things, if you blow it up and you look at it, it you know, she looks very feral in that, you know, in that, you know, picture. It's like
she's on the prowl.
She's breaking loose, right?
She's turning to desire.
The whole idea about freedom, and also the whole idea of sort of this free-flowing approach to songwriting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you're getting at is that, you know, there's not conventional song structures here in a lot of cases.
Oh, that part is cool.
Bunny is a Writer is a pretty straight ahead thing, but the tracks really kind of come at you from different angles. You know, you mentioned what sounded like a bagpipe. It is in fact a bagpipe. She hired a bagpipe player to play on this record. You know, I mean, there's all these different elements, as you were pointing out.
Look, I was anti-bagpipe when Big Country was doing bagpipes.
Well, what about AC/DC? They had bagpipes on a record. You know, I mean, it's not the most terrible thing.
It is. It, you know, is a horrible
Big Country,
instrument.
Right?
Horrible, horrible instrument.
The fact that she's sort of changing up the formulas over and over again, it almost gets too much. And I think that this record is on the teetering on the brink of being a mess, you know, because you're just kind of like, where is it coming from?
She crosses bedroom recording artist with stadium pop diva. I love that. I'd like to hear the demos for many of these songs because it's just, you know, the filigree becomes distracting.
Yeah, and that's it. There's almost too much of a good thing because I think she's a very adventurous artist.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing I will say that I really like about this record, she's got a great voice. She's doing a lot of, you know, high-end stuff, high vocal range stuff in this record. But the way she's orchestrating her vocals, and I will point to one song in particular, Blood and Butter, the bagpipe song, you know? Her wordless vocals, the way she's sort of turning those into a choir on that song, you know, and descending like a waterfall. I mean, it's just a beautiful moment on this record where she's using her voice as a rhythm instrument, right? And another texture in the record. There's a lot to recommend this record. It's just a lot that could have been trimmed back and maybe structured a little bit more.
Greg, as journalists, you and I know everyone needs an editor.
That's right.
But that's what we think of the Caroline Polachek album. And now we want to hear from you. Share your opinions on a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up next, our conversation with New York Times journalist Ben Cesario about Ticketmaster Live Nation on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
And we're back. This week we're having a discussion about Ticketmaster and Live Nation. In recent months, Ticketmaster has been under fire by consumers and lawmakers alike for monopolistic behavior, in particular after the failed Taylor Swift pre-sale. Astronomical prices, bots and resellers, and questionable practices in general are making it more difficult than ever for music fans to get tickets to concerts. Senators are continuing to pressure the Justice Department.
Greg, I feel like you and I have been writing about Ticketmaster our entire professional careers. And now, thankfully, we have the man who is owning the beat for the New York Times, Ben Cesario, one of our favorite music journalists. Ben, welcome back to Sound Opinions.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's awesome.
Well, you know, there are a few people who are as up to date on the Ticketmaster story, the never-ending saga of government saying, this is a monopoly, Ticketmaster Live Nation. It does bad things. People on the left, people on the right, right? I covered the Ticketmaster hearings in the wake of Pearl Jam's assault, right? Always, you know, always portrayed wrongly as Pearl Jam had this crusade. No, the Justice Department had an ongoing investigation under President Clinton that they turned to bands like Pearl Jam and asked them, are you happy with Ticketmaster? Pearl Jam, amazingly, you know, was upset about the charge the Ticketmaster added to a $5 ticket, you know, in Chicago. Then there was the merger of Ticketmaster Live Nation. Some of the same people testifying as at the first hearing, at the second hearing. That happens under the Obama administration. His chief of staff is then future Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, whose brother sits on the board of directors of Live Nation, right? That merger goes through the Justice Department, although you have unlikely allies Chuck Schumer and Orrin Hatch both saying this is a bad thing. It happens anyway. And now, thanks to Taylor Swift, we have yet another round of congressional hearings about, and a Justice Department investigation, the third of my time on this beat. Is anything going to change, man?
Oh, no, nothing has changed. absolutely not.
Okay, thanks for coming on Sound Opinions, Ben Cesario.
I mean, Ticketmaster is still Ticketmaster. They're still doing what they do. I mean, just 3 years ago now, you know, they were caught by the Department of Justice for violating their consent decree. That's the rules and regulations they're supposed to follow that was set down to approve the merger. That basically comes down to, like, you know, you can't be bullies out there forcing venues to use Ticketmaster, and you can't say, hey, you know, Arena X, if you don't use Ticketmaster, you're not getting the big tour next year. They're not allowed to do that.
Right.
But they were caught doing exactly those things multiple times. And then, you know, the only real punishment was they extended the decree. There was a small fee that they had to pay. I think it was a few million bucks. I don't remember exactly. But it was a pretty small punishment. They extended the decree. So here we are yet again. And as you said, in some ways, this is a movie that we've seen multiple times. What has changed, I think, is number one, the music, the live concert business is much bigger, more valuable than it ever has been before. The money that mm-hmm. they were talking about at Pearl Jam's time 30 years ago was nothing compared to the, like $10, $20 billion business that concerts are now. And a lot of the questions about scalping, the value of that whole thing, that has really exploded. In a way, Taylor Swift is just the latest Pearl Jam, right? Like she's an artist who speaks out, complains about things that seem unfair in the music business from an artist's point of view. But, you know, she's the queen of the social media age. And when she speaks out about this stuff, people get very riled up in a way that I don't think they quite did before. So part of the difference is just simply Taylor Swift, that she really did raise the profile of this. It was interesting to see the hearings that, first of all, just the unanimity of the senators and how angry they were about Ticketmaster. Mm-hmm. They really beat the crap out of them. And they were very skeptical of the answers that Live Nation gave in response to their questions. It was also interesting to see how prepared they were. I wasn't expecting that. I mean, I think that we've seen so many times that when people in Congress have this opportunity to interrogate powerful people in business, a lot of times they just blow it with silly, ignorant questions. We saw that with a lot of the Facebook hearings.
Social media hearings,
Zuckerberg,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, it was embarrassing. That was absolutely not the case. And, you know, we saw the senators being well-prepared, having a lot of information. I think some of that information was supplied by journalists in the form of the articles that we've been writing for many years documenting all of this stuff. Some of the activists that have been writing, you know, legal papers about it. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, in some way, there was a little bit of a snowball where, like, the history has... I don't think we can say it's quite caught up to them, but there's enough documented history and enough heat that I think the senators were very effective in just putting the heat on Ticketmaster, scaring them a little bit. I guess we can go into more about this, but, you know, I was left wondering at the conclusion of the hearing what happens next. That's the big question.
That's exactly my question too, Ben, because, you know, I covered Pearl Jam in 95 and it seemed like that was kind of like a dog and pony show. Oh, we got these famous rock stars talking to us, but there was you never sensed that there was going to be any real snowball effect from that. 2010, what you just said about the hearings we just had a few weeks ago, that was the same scenario in 2010. I mean, these guys are getting killed up there. The Live Nation Ticketmaster merger was just being destroyed by the committee asking questions. The legislative committee, and nothing
happened.
Justice Department says no. Actually, we're good. We'll let this merger go through.
It's America. Everything, we're going to put some rules here.
Everything they predicted that would go wrong did go wrong. Mm-hmm. Look at where fees are now. I mean, you know, Pearl Jam's complaining about a $1.50 increase on an $18.50 ticket. And here we are, 50%, 60% of a ticket price being upped because of fees. I mean, it's just insane how much it costs. Forget about the fact that Taylor Swift's ticket sale was botched. The fact that fees are so extraordinarily high without any competition, really, is to me like so egregious, exactly what everybody predicted. Why will this hearing be any different? And I agree with all your points. I thought they did a great job, but Is anything going to happen? I just don't see it happening.
I don't like to be in the prediction business.
Right.
I think it would be very challenging. Senator Klobuchar, who called the meeting and gave the introduction, and she sort of gave a summation toward the end where she said basically, okay, you know, maybe there's some things we can do in Congress, specifically having to do about bots and so forth. But then she basically said, what we're really doing here is just getting facts on the record, and then we're going to hand it over to the Department of Justice. And it's their job to prosecute an antitrust case or to make the decision about doing that. And so the real question is the Justice Department going to do anything? That would be a huge case. I mean, that would be a very, very big burden for them. Calls to break up a major company, which is really the only remedy that I think would satisfy the critics, and the only remedy that would address the root problem that they're talking about here. Because it's not really just about like, oh, the fees are a little bit too high. It's that maybe the structure of this entire business needs to be changed. So, you know, a breakup of a major company is rare, and you can bet that there would be a gigantic court case, which would be zealously defended by Live Nation. That's a very high hurdle, and I'm sure that the lawyers at the Justice Department are thinking very hard about that. You know, that's a very opaque agency. You know, we don't know what they're thinking and what they're doing, but we know that they're interested in this. We know that they are investigating this.
And the Biden administration has made antitrust an issue in other industries.
I view some of that as political theater, though. I mean, it's like it's an easy point to score with angry constituents and consumers. And I think that the laissez-faire approach we have in this country to capitalism, it just makes it a high hurdle to do and to say, okay, well, we approved the merger 13 years ago. And then, you know, even when there were violations of the consent decree that we put into place, really the remedy that we took, the thing that we thought was appropriate, was to fine them a few million dollars and then just extend the decree. So if I were Live Nation, I think I would have a pretty strong case to say, look, you approved us. You let us operate this way for 13 years. How can you suddenly turn around and say that our business is illegal? It's also interesting to see within the power structure of Live Nation, there have been some changes lately. One is that the antitrust lawyer that they had on retainer for 12, 13 years now, a gentleman named Dan Wall, he's one of the best antitrust lawyers in the country, people tell me. He's a very, you know, he's a heavyweight. He was their outside antitrust counsel. They just hired him. So he now has a high-level corporate position at Live Nation. To me, that would seem to indicate that maybe they're getting ready for a fight. So maybe they are, and maybe it's insurance. Who knows? But that gentleman is now, you know, inside the palace, and maybe they're getting ready for war. We'll see.
Inside the Death Star. When I first started reporting on Ticketmaster and Live Nation, that's what people who even work for them call it, the Death Star. Ben, the defense of Live Nation Ticketmaster is always, hey, it's not us, it's the artist. We do what the artist says, right? Taylor Swift made clear, as Pearl Jam and Aerosmith and REM had before her, that that's not what she wanted, right? So Ticketmaster says, hey, these fees that you all seem to hate, a big portion of that's getting kicked back to the fans. And then we have the third person in this triangle, Ticketmaster, Live Nation, artists, fans, who complain but don't vote with their dollars, right? They still bought those Taylor Swift tickets. To what extent is the inaction of artists to change that? Because Taylor Swift, one of the biggest artists in the world today, could have done things differently had she chosen to play outside the Live Nation Ticketmaster stratosphere. Could she have even done that? And, you know, what's ever going to make fans actually vote with their dollar?
Okay, so one point you made, one question you asked was, could Taylor have done things differently? Mm-hmm. I don't think she could realistically have done things differently in terms of booking a tour. She's playing stadiums. She's obviously the gigantic superstar. There's only so many venues that can accommodate her. There's only so many of those stadiums, and most of them use Ticketmaster. And those are,
they have to, right?
Those are exclusive contracts. Taylor Swift cannot say, hey, Giant Stadium, sorry, MetLife Stadium. I can't help it. I'm old fashioned. I still say that. Hey, MetLife Stadium, I don't want to use this other thing. I don't want to use Ticketmaster. I want to use my favorite one. It's not going to happen. So she had no choice in terms of the ticketing service of where she wanted to play. And at the level that she's operating, there just aren't that many venues to play.
No, and there weren't with Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam tried playing in parks, and they
couldn't really do it.
Right.
I think there probably were things that Taylor could have done differently. Taylor and her team, which are very sophisticated professionals. I mean, the one that other people have pointed to is about staggering the on-sale dates. I just think it's a little bit of a red herring to blame the artist in that equation. Because, yes, to some extent, Ticketmaster is doing the job that they're hired to do on behalf of venues and of artists, but they are the dominant vendor in the space, and they're going to give their advice. Right. They're going to say, hey, Taylor Swift, or hey, Beyonce, or hey, Rihanna, or hey, Bruce Springsteen, this is what we can offer you. We have this verified fan thing. We got this. We got that. What do you want to do? I don't think that they're realistically going to examine the Ticketmaster system and demand a lot of changes. I think that they offer them a menu and the artist has to pick something. And I say that without a great deal of visibility into it. But I think that's the way it works. From what I just see at the outside, I mean, Live Nation and Ticketmaster, they basically blame bots for the problem. That was their response in Congress, was there were so many bots trying to get tickets that they outnumbered fans and they cluttered up the system. And also,
but some of the bots were from their own scalping companies that they control. No,
I don't know.
I mean, they also have a hand in the secondary market.
Jim, you know, I'm quite careful about what I say here because I'm a reporter covering this beat. Clearly they're involved in the secondary market because they operate a secondary marketplace. It's of great value to them. They've been caught in the past scalping tickets. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal many years ago about Neil Diamond, where Neil Diamond, who was managed by Irving Azoff, who at the time was the CEO of Ticketmaster, was, guess what? He's scalping his own tickets. So, you know, I have to say that, like, they're clearly involved, but I don't know what you're asking.
No, it's hard. It's hard to parse. They are not cooperative in talking to the public and talking to their customers. I always make this point. You have a bad transaction with Ticketmaster or a problem at a Live Nation venue, try to find a phone number. You know,
yeah.
Jerry Michelson of Jam Productions, one of the few independent remaining promoters. He was there for the first hearing. He's there for the second. He was there at the third. You know, I mean, they're listed on Goethe Street here in Chicago. You can call them up. You see him at shows with his little dog and you can complain to Mr. Michelson. Hey, try doing that with anybody at Ticketmaster or Live Nation.
But to answer your question about, what could they have done, et cetera. And I said that Live Nation blamed the bots. They said there were too many bots. And also the bots were attacking their servers, et cetera. I think somewhere in Joe Berchtold's prepared statements, you will see an acknowledgement that they should have spread out the ticketing dates.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't make a big fuss out of that, but they did say that. I mean, that seems I mean, that's absolutely elementary.
Yeah.
Right? So let's think about it. Like, they know this.
Right.
Did they tell Taylor, hey, we think that that's what we should do here? And she said, no way. I want everything on day one. That's possible. I mean, there was some speculation that what Taylor wanted was the record-breaking number of the tickets sold on one day. So it's possible. I don't know the answer to that. But you have to imagine that if your job is running the system, and if you know that spreading out those tickets over many days will limit the demand, will limit the traffic, will be a better way to accommodate all this garbage, you know, bots that comes in, that you might, it's sort of like, you know, if you tell the doctor, I want to check out of the hospital, they say like, okay, but then you got to sign this release saying you're like denying medical advice here. If it was that bad, and they had a good indication that the demand was going to be extraordinary, you just have to imagine that Ticketmaster was driving that conversation about how this is going to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, if we're wrong, like, tell me. But I don't think so.
Coming up next, we talk through the large fees on concert tickets and where all that money is supposedly going. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we are back. Let's get back to our conversation with the New York Times journalist Ben Cesario.
What about the fees issue? That seems to be like a cause of outrage for a lot of consumers that I talk to that, you know, say, what's going on with this? It's just gotten completely out of hand. Do you sense any movement in that area? I mean, I guess the solution would be like just fold it into the ticket price and say, okay, here's what the ticket price is. But then that's where the artist should be stepping up and saying, hey, I don't mind charging my fans $100, but $175 a ticket, I don't want that. The artists don't seem to have a say in that, where Ticketmaster can separate out this money after they've made an agreement with the artist. Like, okay, and by the way, we're going to get like 75% of what you're charging on top of it so that we can get paid. I mean, I don't understand why that hasn't become like exhibit A of what this is all about too.
Well, I think on one level, the fees are obviously ridiculous. And since the fees are computed as a percentage, it also looks like pure greed because, you know, if the average ticket fee 10 years ago, let's say it was 30%, ticket prices are higher now. So the 30% that you charge now should also be a higher amount of money. But now if it's 50 or 60%, it's even higher. What is the justification? I mean, like the part of what the venue and the ticketing people will say is, you know, the fee is where we will make our money putting on the show because most of the face value goes to the artist. When we're talking about really big ticket concerts like Taylor Swift and so forth, it's a different story at the club level. But when you're talking about somebody playing Madison Square Garden or whatever, most of the face value of the ticket does go to the artist. The promoter would take the rest of that part of the face value. The fee is where the others are supposed to make their money. The venue, the ticket or two. I've been told that there's some with some big artists that there are kickbacks to them as well. But I don't think that's I don't think that's the norm. I think this is one where like the genie can't be put back into the bottle. Because if a ticket costs, I mean, I was going to say $100, but we have to say $300 now. If the ticket costs $300 and the artist is getting $270 of that ticket, that's $30 for the promoter. That's not very much, right? It's something, but it's not a lot to cover all of their costs. So the only way that they're going to make money on the show is by charging a fee on top of it and then making money on all the beer and popcorn and parking and stuff. And you better believe that's what they do. So the only way for that equation to change is if the artist takes less of the gross. I can't think of an artist that would ever want to do that.
we've said that. I mean, David Crosby singing Get Us All Back to the Garden and was defending $500 tickets and hanging up on me and Greg whenever we interviewed him, right? Sir Paul McCartney, well, Jim, I just do what the market says, you know? Yeah, okay, right. Artists are not going to change. They're going to complain. I asked about fans, Ben. It is enormously frustrating, given the hundreds of hours of my career that I've devoted to reporting on Ticketmaster Live Nation. Nobody will ever
gotta
say
be
a good
more than
word
hundreds.
Them.
Gotta be thousands.
Maybe at this point,
yeah.
People are like, this is never going to change, right? So fans are complaining all the time. Nobody. It's hard to come up with a more reviled company, you know, in any field than Ticketmaster Live Nation. Everybody hates them. Everybody. And yet they continue to use them, right? Unless there's a consumer revolt, I'm not going to give my money to Ticketmaster. I'm not going to give it to Live Nation. You know, I don't think things are ever going to change. Tell me why I'm wrong, brother.
I don't think things would ever change for that reason, because of the feelings that fans have for the artists they love. They want to see Beyonce. They want to see Taylor Swift. And if they have to go through hell to do it, they'll do it. And sure, nobody likes Ticketmaster. To some extent, Ticketmaster is set up to be the punching bag there. Like they're there partly to absorb that bad PR on behalf of a lot of parties. That doesn't mean that they're innocent.
I was really satisfied during these hearings to see people use the construction I've always used: Live Nation / Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
Because Live Nation wants to pretend that it isn't Ticketmaster. Everybody hates Ticketmaster. They're the bad cop, right? You got to hate the whole Death Star together. It's one big bad thing.
I don't think the Death Star was a merger, though. I think that was one entity.
Yeah, that's true. And it got blown up.
I do think, though, that there is one way in which people vote with their dollars, which is they go to fewer concerts. That if you are a fan of Beyonce and you have to see her, you're going to log on and you're going to get riled up and you're going to pay up the wazoo and you're going to hate that. But you want to see her. And you're going to do it. But you know, maybe Janet Jackson tours, maybe, I don't know, somebody else tours. And you say, you know what, we spent $900 on those tickets and like, I don't have the money for that. There's also times that I have just felt like, I don't want to deal with it. You know, I know that the tickets are going to get scooped up. They're going to get scalped. I would love to see Radiohead right now. I'm just not going to do it. So I you know, one thing that Ticketmaster and Live Nation often say about this is that there's a relatively small number of concerts that the average fan goes to in a year. It might only be one or two. And they're going to go to their favorite band. And so they want to wring as much out of that one transaction as they can. Mm. If the prices were lower, if the system was easier to use, if it felt fairer, maybe people would go to more concerts. Maybe, you know, maybe people would be willing to, you know, give it a shot. I remember that when the verified fan program was rolled out, I don't know, 5 years ago or something at this point, Hamilton was on Broadway. I wanted to see it. But it was the hottest thing on Broadway and tickets sold out and they were being scalped all over the place. And I just felt like, you know what? I don't want to deal with it. And then they did verified fan for Hamilton and I did it. And I got tickets and I was very happy. I didn't have to pay a scalper. I bought my tickets and I don't know, they were like $400 or something, but they were worth it. I had a great time. I did wonder, I got to tell you, whether some gnome inside of Ticketmaster saw my name pop up and thought, you know,
they have our pictures on there.
You know,
Well, you know, the thing I'm hearing you say, though, Ben, is that even if they got the tickets kind of in a better place in terms of the fees and maybe didn't charge as much.
Verifying.
Fans still wouldn't go because part of the argument is that the industry is shooting itself in the foot by saying we're going to charge buku bucks for Bruce Springsteen or Beyonce, and that's going to suck all that money out of the concert economy because the fans aren't going to be able to go see artists B, C, and D on their list because they spent all their money on one act. But I think I'm kind of hearing you say that these fans only really go to see one show a year, and they're going to pay whatever that price is, but they're not going to. B, C, and D, really, they're not really going to go to that show. I mean, it's like, that would be my second choice, but I'm not going to go to it if I'm going to go see this first show.
Two-tiered system. John Lennon, you know, cheap people in the cheap seats, right. Clap your hands, everybody else rattle your jewelry.
Right. We're not that excited about everything. Like, we're not going to go to multiple shows a year. I mean, I'm just curious about your feeling about that.
I mean, I only have anecdotal information about that. I think we sort of see that happening, but I don't have hard data about it. I do think that the fact that Live Nation has been saying something like this for a long time, that, you know, their average customer may only go to one concert a year. Now they're getting all the customers. They're getting super fans and they're getting, you know, people who don't care about music all that much. And maybe they go to one show. They get families. They get people going to Disney on Ice or whatever. So I don't know exactly what they're saying. I wish I had more information, but just speaking anecdotally and personally, I do feel that the high price of tickets, the hassle of the secondary market, and the way that that feels like it's now unavoidable, it's this criminal element that is everywhere. is a very defeating environment to be in if you are just sort of an average fan looking to buy a ticket. Why do I want to put up with this? And it raises the bar to a pretty high level to say, okay, I'll do it for Beyonce. But am I going to do it for artists B, C, and D? Maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sad. Mm-hmm. I think that's a sad thing for music and for fans. I do know that, like, the club level is okay, but it feels like there are two different music businesses right now. Like, our whole sort of pop music landscape is these like mega deity superstars. And then I feel like when I'm looking at the level of like 600 capacity venues, those people just they're nowhere. Like the fact that Spotify and et cetera, like that there are charts telling us what people are listening to, and we're only kind of seeing this like upper crust of Drake and Taylor and everything else, but we're just not getting that sense of like what's on college radio these days. I feel like that's something that there used to be a certain amount of siloing to music where there were many different levels of fandom and of genres that in some ways had their own independent ecosystems where the indie band wasn't really competing with Madonna. But now there's a single level in which everybody competes. And if you are not in that Madonna, Taylor, Bruce, Beyonce position, you're kind of invisible. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, yeah. You know, especially if a club or a theater has a Ticketmaster deal going on, right? I know a lot of fans that go to a lot of shows, but they're like small club shows. And, you know, they're paying, what, $20 at the door or $15. Those are affordable, but yeah, it reminds me of the economy in general. There's the 1% and the 99%, and the 1% gets all the money. Right?
No, and you know, I mean, it has to be said, Ben, when you hear somebody from Live Nation speak, if you go back to Michael Rapino's talks, if you go back to their statements annually to the shareholders, I mean, their vision is to control everything from the 150 capacity club to the Enormo Dome. You know, they've never made a secret of that. You know, they talk about it at great, you know, and now, especially in a place like Chicago or in New York, you know, we have a dozen thriving mid-sized venues and smaller, you know, that hold on. But in a lot of cities like Detroit or Minneapolis, you know, it's Live Nation you're dealing with from the small club, the mid-sized theater, all the way to the stadium.
Let's not leave AEG out of this because they don't have the same issues that Ticketmaster does, that Live Nation and Ticketmaster. But they are also a very large corporation, and they...
But what's the percentage now Live Nation controls X percent and AEG controls what of the promotion, venue concert business. Promotion?
I don't know. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I do know that I recently did a story about the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, because this was one where it had been a Ticketmaster venue since it opened for about a decade, and then they switched to this other company, SeatGeek, just about a year later, SeatGeek lost the deal, even though it was a 7-year contract, and they went back to Ticketmaster, and we still don't know the whole story of what happened there. Live Nation denies that there was any retaliation toward the venue. The venue won't really say. There's been some chatter that SeatGeek was unsatisfactory in how it performed its duties. That may be possible, but it's an interesting case to look at that. Anyway, when I was researching that, I sort of pulled all the data I could about concerts at the arenas in the greater New York City market. That's Barclays, that's Madison Square Garden. There's a venue in Newark, New Jersey called the Prudential Center. And then there's a brand new one on Long Island called the UBS Arena. And so there's essentially four similarly sized arenas in the greater New York market. And at Barclays, there was a decline in the number of Live Nation shows after they switched ticketers. But there was also a decline in all the other stuff. I mentioned that only just because, to be fair to Live Nation, it's very murky about what happened there. But one thing I did see is that the number of Live Nation promoted concerts at any of these places far exceeds the number of AEG shows. AEG does Taylor Swift, they do Justin Bieber, they do Ed Sheeran, they do the Rolling Stones. But there's a pretty big drop after I think they did Elton John. Anyway, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I can tell you that Live Nation does multiple times the number of shows, the number of tours that AEG But I,
last time I checked, I think it was like AEG was like 30%.
Sounds about right.
Or something like that. But
the point I wanted to make.
Live Nation dwarfs.
The point I wanted to make is that AEG owns venues. It owns, or at least has a large share in big festivals like Coachella. They are the part owner in Bowery Presents in New York, which is a very big sort of empire on the East Coast of venues. It's not only New York City, it's Boston. They just built a brand new venue in Boston called Roadrunner. There's one in Richmond, Virginia. They were in Philadelphia. They're sort of all over the place here. So the point is, as you were saying, like Live Nation, they kind of want to be like the big arena in town and also the club. AEG wants that too. And it's been pointed out that in a lot of major cities, there aren't that many venues to go that have no affiliation with one of those two businesses. And that these two companies that are based in Los Angeles are essentially like running a very large chunk of the live music business of the entire country. I think that's very concerning for just the level of corporate control of cultural business in America. There should be more competition. There should be more challenges to them. I know that for smaller promoters, one of the things that they will say is like, look, it's just hard out here for us. Like, we don't have the resources that those big companies have. And like, if our show tanks, we might go out of business. If Live Nation show tanks, they might have 99 other ones to make up for it. So, there's nothing illegal, I don't think, about that. It's just unfair. And it's just unfortunate that there is such a tremendous disparity in the power and the size and the resources of the companies that are working in this space. I wanted to say one more random thing. It's been interesting to me to think about Lina Khan, the head of the Federal Trade Commission, the Live Nation Ticketmaster merger was handled by the Department of Justice. And there is this consent decree. It's overseen by a judge in Washington. And so anything that happens will have to involve the Justice Department. But it's interesting that the Federal Trade Commission is now run by a person who has a very deep and incisive critique of antitrust law in the United States.
That's what I was referring to earlier. There was that big New Yorker profile of her anti-monopoly mindset.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know her current age, but she's quite young, and she rose to prominence as a law student writing a paper that completely took down contemporary antitrust law and basically said that the original intention of these laws that go back a century or more now, they were intended to protect competition in the marketplace. And gradually, I think Robert Bork was the key player in why this changed, but that gradually they have only looked at the effect on pricing on consumers. And so as long as pricing remains low, companies are allowed to do anything they want. Her big target was Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to wonder whether this drama would be different if Lina Khan was the person prosecuting this. I don't know what Merrick Garland thinks about Live Nation. I don't think he said a word about it. But we know what Lina Khan thinks about Amazon. And you can only imagine that if this case were to land on her desk, she would be aggressive about it. So I imagine that Live Nation is quite grateful about that situation.
You got to hope that Garland has a couple of nieces who are Taylor Swift fans, or that he really wants Bruce Springsteen to.
He's got a few other things on his plate right now.
Yeah, saving democracy.
I mean, Ben,
I know.
Ben, you did a really good job of outlining how intensive, from a time and people power you know, investment this would be for anyone to take on this. You know, they built a monster. Now they how do you stop it? How do you dismantle it? It would be an incredible uphill climb, I would imagine, even for the Justice Department.
Not even COVID threw Live Nation for a loop.
Right.
You know, it recovered just fine.
Oh, Live Nation stock went to its highest price ever.
Yeah.
So what happens when you're a monopoly?
Oh, man.
Ben, you've been very generous with your time. We really
do appreciate it.
We learned a lot. So thank you for doing that. Thanks for coming on Sound Opinions once again.
Thank you very much, guys.
That wraps up our discussion on Ticketmaster Live Nation, but not the issue. We want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts. Greg, what's on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, a fascinating discussion with Dr. Ricky Rodriguez, who wrote a book called A Kiss Across the Ocean, about the cultural exchange between Latin America and the UK in terms of music.
Yeah, great stuff. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.